Well, I have a couple of tough acts to follow. I'll do my best, although my assignment makes what I will have to say pretty much in the nature of an autobiography. I have just come from the Cape Cod of Massachusetts, which is the extension of the arm out like this from the state of Massachusetts with its fist doubled up toward Great Britain and Europe. The things we have had handed to us in the areas of my interest, the social gospel, Christian socialism, and so on, began last century. In 1848, the very year of the Communist Manifesto, a couple of Church of England parsons, F.D. Morris and Charles Kingsley, sat down and decided that a movement of Christian socialists was imminent. And so they started, I guess they used the name they coined. Christian socialism was founded by these two men in 1848, and there is in the manifesto a derisive recognition of the development of the idea of Christian socialism, which the manifesto said was Christianity adopted as a way to ease the heart burning of the aristocrats. Time passed. In the 1870s, a popular slogan was Christianity is the religion of which socialism is the practice. In this country, in 1908, was founded the Federal Council of Churches. This had been preceded by a number of books by American ministers, one called Social Action, and books of that type, but the union of a number of courts of this type of thinking, attempting to provide the better means for the expression of religion by political doctrines. 1908, the Federal Council of Churches was founded. A few years before that, the Methodists put out put together a group to provide information about the proper social conduct of the churches or the political conduct, and it was affairs of that sort that joined the churches in the Federal Council of Churches rather than any kind of a doctrinal accord. In 1812, a man named Harry F. Ward, who throughout most of his career at Union Theological Seminary was a spokesman for the Soviet Union, or rather I should say for the social gospel, which later translated into its affection for the socialist union. Harry F. Ward continued at Union Theological Seminary and was often on the warpath visiting different seminaries on behalf of the social gospel and Christian socialism. I forget when he died, but it was sometime in the late 30s. I had a teacher at seminary up in Berkeley named John Bennett. He was there for one semester only, but he developed into a person who wrote a book called Social Salvation, and he, with Reinhold Niebuhr, wrote and lectured on the premise that Christianity, properly understood, would result in some kind of a socialistic or social gospel. Bennett wrote a book called Social Salvation. Niebuhr, back in about 1933, who was a professor at Union Theological Seminary in New York, wrote a book with the intriguing title, Moral Man and Immoral Society. And its point was that we ordinary people treat our neighbors fairly well. We act in terms of some of the benevolent doctrines of the Bible, but in the field outside the neighborhood and private religion, we have a jungle going on. We call it capitalism, which is a system which enriches the rich at the expense of the poor. Now, you would think that if the rich got rich at the expense of the poor, they should be plastered with the label of abject idiocy. A person who wants to increase his income by stealing steals from the rich and not the poor, obviously. Niebuhr had done a lot of work in the field of attempting to blend religion with socialism, but in about 1938 and 9, he gave the Gifford Lectures in Scotland, a series of lectures begun in 1888, of which I'm a fan. I've got about 35 of the Gifford Lectures. They are considered to be the best series of lectures available in the Protestant world. In the 1930s, I was in classrooms most of that period. I got through high school in 1932, college in 1936, seminary in 1939, up in Berkeley, as was mentioned. I returned to Massachusetts and was given an opportunity to be the assistant minister in the town of Beverly, Massachusetts, about 20 miles north of Boston, the next town to Salem. The church was the first church of Beverly, 1667, and I became the assistant minister for about 14 months. Lovely town, wonderful people, and the man I worked under was a white-haired, genial, saintly type of a person. And then I was sent to a little church in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, when Harrisburg was full of mills, which deposited soot on the windowsills of about every place in town. While in Harrisburg, I taught full-time at Harrisburg Academy and was there as the war broke out. Within a year or so, I began to feel uncomfortable about my being in a position not to experience some of the things which my peers and some younger were experiencing in various parts of the world. So I thought I might become a chaplain. But someone to whom I talked who knew more about this said, the denominations each have a quota, and those quotas, I think, are full at the present time, but a better job for you would be the American Red Cross. So I joined the American Red Cross overseas in India and spent close to 2 years there, went over in 44 and came back after the war in 46. In 46, there was a vacant pulpit in the town of Hingham, 20 miles south of Boston, second parish. The second parish was about 2 miles from the center of town where there was the first parish. This was an old church too, 1742. A resident of Hingham was a man named Henry Beston. I've been reading his column in the Progressive, which was the La Follette paper in Wisconsin. It was farm labor right in policy, anti-war or anti-inventionism, with regular features by Harry Elmer Barnes. And then this column about this man Beston's farm in Maine called Chimney Farm. I should have mentioned that this Beston wrote a real nature classic called Outermost House. He lived for 12 months on the beach, the Nauset Beach, which is the furthest part of this country beyond the ocean. Outermost House was published in 1928. I bought a copy in 1947. It was the 14th edition. It continues to be reprinted almost year after year. Beautiful book. Try to get a copy. I've often taken walks in the woods with Henry Beston, who knew every weed, every tree, every flower that we came across and could talk about it. At night, he could tell you stories about the stars. Great person, his wife was Elizabeth Coatsworth, who wrote some novels and a lot of poetry and several classic children's books, plus a history of Hingham called South Shore Town. One day, Henry Beston came walking up to the house where we lived, waving what looked like a tabloid. It was a four-page fold, a paper called Analysis, edited and written by Frank Chodorov. I loved it. It was right down my alley, so I sent immediately for copies of that particular issue with a larger copy devoted to Albert J. Nock. I ordered, I think, 20 copies of the Nock issue, which was twice as large as the normal issue, and subscribed to Analysis and wrote Frank Chodorov a fan letter. Next time I was in New York, after we had several exchanges of letters, I made my way down to the street where his office was located. It was in a shabby section of Manhattan on the Manhattan side of the end of the Brooklyn Bridge. There was a shabby office building, looked like it might fall down any time, and I walked in, and there was an elevator surrounded by wire, not by, you know, bars and whatever. I got in, pushed the button, and it slowly grunted its way up to the fourth floor. I get out, and there was an office at Frank Chodorov. I knocked, and this man appeared at the door, or in the doorway, smoking a pipe, a deep curved Sherlock Holmes type of a pipe. He had sort of a beard, bald head, tubby, a tubby sort of a person. And I said, I'm Opitz, thinking that he might remember my name. And he asked me a question never asked of me before. Which Opitz are you? Seemed that he had a correspondent in Baltimore, an engineer, and the son of that engineer was in Florida, so he had two Opitzes before me. Well, he and I seemed to hit it off just right. He gave me all the previous issues of his paper, Analysis, spelled defiantly with a small A, and I have a whole set of them. In speech, Frank Chodorov was a typical soapboxer, of which he had done a lot in the course of his career. His professional career later was head of the Schockenbach Foundation. Frank was a single taxer, a follower, a believer in the man who gave us some of the terms of land rent and taxation by simply taking the rent of land. Otherwise, Henry George was a fair economist. Not quite what to expect these days. My good fortune was to have in college a year in economics with the textbook Principles of Economics by Fairchild, Furness, and Buck. Fred Fairchild was the head of the Department of Economics at Yale and a founding member, trustee of the Foundation for Economic Education. And I saw a lot of Fred during the course of my years there. He died maybe in the 1950s. And frequently I drove him back to Hartford, I should say, not Hartford, but wherever Yale happened to be, and we got pretty well acquainted. But I was lucky in the sense that I got a book on economics which dealt strictly with free market economics and not the variations that were appearing during the 1930s and 40s. This section of the country has meant a lot to the libertarian movement. First of all, there was James W. Fifield, Jr., who came to occupy the pulpit of the First Congregational Church in Los Angeles, I think back in about 34 or 35. This was a stupendous church with a large congregation and a large debt. The debt was $75,000, $750,000. And Fifield, when called, said he would promise to pay off that debt in 3 years, and he did it. He was a tall, lanky, loosely jointed person with a wonderful voice, slightly stooped because of his height, but a commanding presence in all. Gave a great sermon. He could speak to all kinds of audiences. He had a golfing service in the morning in his church, the regular service at 10:30, an afternoon service, and then in the evening he had a forum. To which he invited members with well-known credentials in various parts of the country and attracted enormous audiences of several thousand people. That tapered off when the situation in Los Angeles became dangerous to be out in the evening, so the second time I spoke there, whereas the first time the church was almost full, the second time tabbed as a subordinate to the whims of business. He was alleged to be financed by the National Association of Manufacturers. Now, we know that manufacturers are evil people, and of course, an alliance of manufacturers is 10 times as evil. It was alleged that this organization paid his salary, in effect, and I eventually, when I got acquainted with him, said, what about this allegation that you are supported by the National Association of Manufacturers. Well, he said, several years ago, I was invited to speak in one of their gatherings. It was set up an auditorium. I gave my lecture, and I walked toward the wings when it was finished, and there was a man with a notebook. He said, Dr. Fifield, what are your expenses? And I said, well, round-trip airfare, $250. Thank you, said the guy, and he walked away. That was the last money he ever got from the NRA, the only money. Didn't even get his hotel bill paid or the meals he had to eat or getting from the airport back and forth to his home. I did, when I was invited to join the staff of the foundation, go to the library and consult the New York Times Index, which has an index of most of the stuff that's appeared in the New York Times. So I checked out several things that were listed as spiritual mobilization. Seemed innocent to me, namely just ordinary sort of a gathering that people of a similar set of ideas would have. Nothing that was alleged against spiritual mobilization as to its propensity for the free market offended any of my senses. I was, in fact, pleased that this organization did exist and would eventually join it. Meanwhile, Frank Todorov sent me a copy of the first issue of a journal published by Spiritual Mobilization called Faith and Freedom, in which Frank Todorov had an article. His article was called Federalized Race Prejudice. Now, Frank Todorov, was a Jew, of course, looked like a Jew, acted like a Jew, proud of it. But Frank did not want the federal government having the kind of power which, what's it called, federal emergency, federal, anyway, it was a federal organization working in the direction of doing the wrong things to harmonize the relation between different sets of people. He sent me the article. I wrote to the editor saying, I'm delighted that there is an organization anywhere addressed to clergy carrying the message which I have gotten from your first issue. And the editor wrote back, a fellow named Bill Johnson. He said, well, I was once employed by the Foundation for Economic Education, was asked to edit the new project of spiritual mobilization, the journal, so I came out here. At the present time, we have now the journal and a radio program featuring Jim Fifield, with Jim Fifield having a closing sermonette after a little drama. And besides that, Bill Johnson, we are thinking about having a program of conferences in different parts of the country, and we're going to have a trial balloon conference up in Wisconsin at Carleton College, and would you like to join us? Well, I said, sure. And I took the train up there, and a conference of about 50 or so people. Millikan, was it Arthur Millikan, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, was on the board of Spiritual Mobilization, and he was there. There were a couple of businessmen from Los Angeles who were friendly, well-disposed, knowledgeable about the free market, and the rest were ministers from different parts of the country. Well, at that time, I had read Adam Smith. I took the book with me to India, read it in India. On the way back from India, I stopped with friends from my Harrisburg church in Long Beach and, of course, went into a secondhand bookshop and picked up a copy of Herbert Spencer's Social Statics. So I was pretty well primed by the time I attended this trial balloon conference in 1950. And in about 6 months, I received an inquiry, would I be interested in starting and running the conference program? So I said, I think so. Well, they sent a fellow named Jim Ingebretson. Ingebretson had been Leonard's lawyer for the Chamber of Commerce, located him in Washington during the war, first of all, because Leonard felt that there was much industry being developed in Southern California, and the chamber needed someone to represent them in Washington, D.C. It's with Jim Ingebretson, a youngish lawyer, a graduate in 39 of Stanford Law School with highest ratings, had an offer from a prestigious law firm in Los Angeles, joined it, and as young lawyers do, got into all sorts of organizations. He was chairman of the Red Cross Drive. He was one of the three harbor commissioners and things of that sort. And a very pleasant, genial sort of a person whom I met not too long after the offer of this conference program was given me. Met Jim Ingebretson, who of course knew Leonard Reed quite well, and we met in the lobby of the hotel just this side of Grand Central Station. And Leonard Reed was there. Leonard Reed was carrying a suspicious-looking longish package under his arm, which we learned was a salmon. He was going to have poached salmon for supper, and I learned that Leonard was a gourmet cook, very proud of his cooking, and built the house that he was to live in on the foundation property so that the kitchen was exposed to people waiting in the parlor. Well, I was impressed by Leonard immediately. He was a tall man with sort of a commanding, pleasant presence, a good speaker, good talker, witty. So that was the contact which eventually led to my joining the Foundation for Economic Education several years after the meeting, because Jim Ingebretson, a man of ample means, began to lose interest in running and raising money for spiritual mobilization, so he bowed out. At which point, Leonard, who was on the board of spiritual mobilization, buttonholed me and said, Ed, would you like to join the staff of the Foundation for Economic Education? Well, I said, Leonard, what would you want me to do? If I had to tell you what to do, I wouldn't hire you. Well, that was an offer I couldn't very well refuse. This was 1955, and I stayed there until 5 years ago, or 92. So I was on the staff of the foundation for the better part of my life. If someone were to ask me, what sort of work did you do when you were more or less in your prime? I said, I did not work when I was in my prime. I had fun. I had enjoyment out of what I was doing. I wouldn't have exchanged it for anything. It was a wonderful experience. We traveled, met a number of great people, one of whom was Dave Keeston, another Ralph Mead, another was Bill here, met him at a seminar in Indianapolis, which his father, I think, put on many years ago. In any event, there wasn't a dull moment, and back in those days, travel was easier. A man who worked at the foundation picked up Leonard. He'd drive to my house in White Plains. We'd head for one of the airports, go right to the red carpet club or one of the other clubs, have a donut and a cup of coffee, walk out the door, and immediately go through where there are now testing of baggage. We'd walk straight through to the plane. We came to realize that it was stupid to go tourist at 145 to the coast when you could get to the coast by 160. So we spent pleasant hours on the plane, and in the 100 or so seminars we had in distant parts, I think we must have had close to 1,000,000 miles in the air. I know that in 1971 or so, I got something from United, 100,000 miles, but that was when we began doing the touring. Naturally, having been working with people of the caliber of Leonard Reed, Paul Perot, an unsung hero of the foundation who was our editor for about 30 years. Imagine getting every month a batch of essays which the author hoped would appear in the Freeman, sorting these out, discarding those which would not fit, and explaining to the person who got the rejected manuscript just how much he, the editor, appreciated this and please try us again. Paul was a quiet person, and not what you'd call gregarious, but he had a way of even turning down manuscripts, which endeared the person turned down to him and to the Freeman. When I first came to the foundation, a man called Baldy Harper, Baldy because, I'm told, in his youth in the Midwest somewhere, had hair that stuck out in all directions, or they called him Baldy. I never got that well acquainted with Baldy Harper, but he was at this conference at Carleton College, and I met him first there and met him again and had many talks with him while he was at the foundation. Leonard, during the period between 1960 and 64, was working on a book which he called Government, an Ideal Government, an Ideal Concept. I think something about that book offended Baldy. I'm not sure what it was, but Baldy began to retreat within himself, and for a period of a year or so, at the Times, twice a day, when we all went down for coffee, Baldy, or in the morning, Baldy would bring his mail and read his mail while the rest of us had our coffee and whatever else there might be. I think Baldy had by that time become offended by the very idea of having a government. I know I've heard people who sort of say, well, it is government that starts and runs the wars, but if there were no government, we'd have no wars, and we would have more theft, maybe a few more murders, but that's a cheap price to pay for avoiding wars. Well, I'm not quite up to grasping that concept, but in any event, Baldy resigned from the foundation. I know Leonard talked to me about it a time or two and said, I can't fire him. But Baldy then had an idea of a little different kind of an organization, the Institute for Humane Studies, which was first of all in California and then moved to Washington, D.C., and has since that time done yeoman service for the cause. It's had some great people attached to it. The Humane Institute published a number of, maybe all of Baldy's writings in a couple of large volumes. It's still going strong today and part of our scene in the effort to repel the invasion of private liberty by the state. During the course of this book that Leonard was writing, Government, an Ideal Concept, I was not then a member of the staff of the foundation. I was 10 miles away, still working for spiritual mobilization in our New York office. Leonard began to write some things which reminded me of some things that a man named Gerald Hurd had written in two little pamphlets, which when I was out here after the war, visiting my friends from Harrisburg, someone gave me these two pamphlets. Harper published them. One and two, Training for the Life of the Spirit. Well, I thought they were important and moving, and that Leonard was moving in that direction. So I said, Leonard, a couple of books by some fellow named Gerald Hurd. Take a look and see what you think. I think this is bearing upon your new book. Oh, within a week after that, I drove over to the foundation. Happened that a couple of our trustees were there. Leonard said, sit down and have lunch with us. So Leonard was at the end of the table. I was one person between us. Henry Hazlitt, across from me. So Leonard leaned over and said, Ed, who is this fellow Gerald Hurd? Well, I began to describe what Hurd was like and what he had written and so on, and Hazlitt perked up his ears. He said, are you talking about Gerald Hurd? I said, yeah. Well, my wife is having lunch in Manhattan at this moment with Gerald Hurd. Well, Leonard was excited. So he said, Henry, can you get the telephone number of the place where Hurd is staying with the private home? So he did, and I telephoned, and Mr. Hurd recognized my name, remarkable memory, and I said, Leonard Reed, who's our president here, has a strong desire to see you. Could we take you to lunch tomorrow or as soon as possible? Well, Gerald answered, yes, I could. I'm free tomorrow noon. So we met him for lunch, not knowing whether a person of his outlook and so on would eat the kind of food we would eat, but he did, and we had a long conversation, and as we drove back, Leonard and myself, Leonard said, that is the most remarkable man I have ever met. Well, Leonard has a gift of meeting people, and he'd met some very important people. But to say this to Gerald Hurd implies that there was something about Gerald which is unique, which I think of is true. Jim Ingebretson, after he resigned from the Spiritual Mobilization presidency, began to develop, likewise, an interest in the kinds of things that Gerald Hurd was writing about and talking about. So when we decided, my wife and I, having two children, one born in California, one in Hingham, that we were not being fair to our parents to have our family grow up so far from the grandparents. So we decided we would leave Spiritual Mobilization, go back to the East Coast, and Jim Ingebretson, then still in charge, no, we'll open an Eastern office. So my family moved to White Plains, New York. First of all, I had an office in the home until the kids got big enough to climb around, and one of my daughters, I recall, picked up the toothbrush affair that you clean the type with and came in and showed me what happened. Blackened mouth. Anyway, we moved back to White Plains, not far from the foundation, raised our kid. My parents were in Worcester, Massachusetts. I should have mentioned earlier, I grew up in a staunchly Republican family. My mother was a stubborn Swede. There's no other kind. She was also a pretty bright person, good administrator, and became, in 1926, the vice chairman of the Republican City Committee in Worcester, a city of 170,000. I have no idea, no recollection of how or why she got that post. The chairman was a male who ran a factory. He was the manufacturer of Royal Worcester Corset Company, which probably most of you don't know what that is, and I'll not explain. Anyway, I grew up in a Republican family, and of course we were all completely anti-Roosevelt. My mother was enamored of Herbert Hoover, thought he was a godsend, and if only he had been Swedish and a Baptist, he would have been the Messiah in her view, I think. In any event, we settled down there for a while, and then I got to going with Leonard, took all these trips around the country, and in 1987, Leonard passed away. I think it was 97. And so things did change a bit, and I was getting older, and we had, as a temporary president, Hans Senholz, who had been a long friend of mine, a very hard-working person who with his wife came from Grove City for 3 years to sort of keep the foundation going. Leonard made no plans for choosing a successor. So the foundation floundered after Leonard's death, having a couple of trustees who did not come to live at the foundation, but who ran it from afar by mail. So by the time we got a president of a permanent sort, who was Bruce Evans, who had been a trustee. He'd been a professor at a couple of colleges and a dean of Abilene Christian College. Was there for 4 years and didn't quite take hold. So he left, and then Hans Senholz, who had just retired from Grove City after 35 years teaching economics, agreed to come as an interim president and did so, and pulled things together. Hans, most of you know probably, was a German Luftwaffe pilot during World War II. Had never been to charm school, but he was tireless, he was dedicated, and after his 3 or 4 years in Irvington, the foundation, I think, was back on even keel. And then the search began for a new president. Search committee examined a number of candidates, and finally, at the last moment, heard about a whiz kid called Don Boudreau. And Don and his wife, Carol, both of whom are dedicated and very bright, were hired as the next president and his wife. And they made some innovative changes at the foundation. I don't agree with all of them, but I do like the people who are doing the work, particularly Don and Carol, his wife, and some other people, too, who have joined the staff as in charge of one department or another. And that's about the way this story ends up to the present time. I'm sorry to have been so focused on my autobiography. And at times when the previous speaker spoke, I had moments when I wondered of whom they were speaking. I will, if you wish, try to answer questions on topics that I've not covered.
As I announced earlier, there will be a book signing out there and the table back there, and I think you can ask questions to Ed personally at that time, so because we have another session starting in about 10 minutes. So I'll give you a little break here, and then we'll reassemble it promptly at 2:05.